After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
You know, something I remind people often is that there's really not many straight lines in grief. It's a natural process, and you know, nature doesn't work in linear time like our calendar years. It works in cycles, and we have to kind of recognize that grief is natural. It's older than civilization.
Hello and welcome to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg. I'm Lily Cushman. I produce this wonderful podcast. And today we're coming to you with episode 236, Sharon speaking with Sameet Kumar, PhD. Sameet is a clinical psychologist for the Memorial Cancer Institute, and he specializes in working with cancer patients and their caregivers and care team. He is the author of several books, Grieving Mindfully and The Mindful Path Through Worry and Rumination. And in May of 2024, he's part of a new anthology that's coming out called How to Grieve What We've Lost, which is kind of a like super anthology from different grief counselors and therapists and psychologists. So this is a really powerful conversation. Sameet's work is deeply inspiring on a lot of levels. And he shares about how he came to grief counseling and just how much of the human experience involves grief, whether we're aware of that or not, and whether those different losses are obvious to us or not. So much of his work is supporting people who are often going through the hardest, most challenging time in their life. And he also started working with frontline workers during COVID. So he holds a pretty tremendous space for people and their pain. And really what he says about grief is that it's whatever it is to you, and that there's not a timeline for grieving. So if you're someone who has encountered a big loss or just feel like grieving work might be a powerful tool for you, this is a wonderful conversation for you. Sameet and Sharon also talk about Ram Dass because of the role that he played in Sameet's life. So that's a very sweet full circle moment. So let's dive in. Sameet Kumar and Sharon Salzberg.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. So how are you and where are you recording from today?
It's really good to be here. I am in South Florida, and the time of this recording, it's a little bit cool, but otherwise we are doing okay.
Oh yeah, a little bit cool. I'm in New England. It's very cold.
It's very cold there.
It's very cold. Well, it's wonderful to be together again, and I'm really looking forward to sharing you with our listeners. And I thought we could begin today with some of your backstory, how you came to your path, and what led you to working with cancer patients and caregivers.
Sure. I have to point out that although I've been doing this for 25 years, I never thought that this is what I would be doing for 25 years. I was raised by mom and dad, and my mom was a survivor of partition, which is a very brutal partitioning of the Indian subcontinent that occurred in 1947. And she witnessed her parents and her brother being killed on a train as part of that. She was at a young age. So when I was born many, many years later, this kind of scar of trauma was something that was very evident in our household, even though it wasn't very much spoken about, it was always present. So, I decided to go into psychology, wasn't quite sure where to go. And having these interests in Buddhism and Dharma practice, I thought that, working in end-of-life care, doing a little charnel ground kind of setting as part of my training would be something good to do and to be exposed to. Little did I know that when I started to sit at the bedside of people who were dying, who were facing their own trauma, my exposure to my mother's trauma made me very comfortable for people who were going through very, very bad things. And it was a very challenging placement for me for the year. And within a few months in, I knew two things. One, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. And two, I can't imagine doing anything else. And really, I haven't looked back. And since then, I'm a clinical psychologist specializing in palliative care and working with cancer patients, many of whom will not survive their disease, many of whom will, more and more of whom will. But really, over the years, I've gravitated towards people who are going through very difficult health situations, under the umbrella of our healthcare system, which is its own trauma.
Yeah, we can talk about that, actually. I agree. We call it, here in my household, we call it the medical industrial complex. Trying
Absolutely.
To get equipment, trying to get insurance. I mean, it's yeah. very difficult for people. So when I think about your professional life, it really strikes me that very often you're supporting people right at the time in their lives when they've just gotten the bad news that none of us really wants to hear. And I find it really inspiring the way you approach grief work. Here's one way you've described it as restoring a sense of sanctity of our pain and a sense of sanctity of the preciousness of human life.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really these times in our lives when it feels like the world is falling apart, when there's no hope, when we can't see what next week or tomorrow is going to be like. It's really those times in our lives that we're thrust into this, this bardo, this intermediate state. And oftentimes, in addition to the pain, that reveals a lot about our human life, about our precious human life, about our values, about our relationships, about what's important and what's suddenly not important, right? There's just so many instances where people have relayed to me that they drove home from the cancer center, had no idea how they got home, right? They were in a daze. Whereas last week, traffic was their obsession, it was the most challenging part of their day was dealing with this kind of almost road rage kind of thing. And now they're driving home and it's just like in a fog, like drivers can do whatever. They're not paying attention anymore. I mean, that's just one little example, but the other examples that really are more profound are what happens to relationships when we ourselves or our loved ones are thrust into that uncertainty and that really acute vulnerability. What helps?
It seems important to address some of the cultural myths that talking about bad things or unpleasant things is not okay in a lot of American culture. Can I remember as a child, no one ever said the word in my presence, cancer, in a normal voice. It was like to whisper it like cancer. And then when I was teaching just a few years ago at a hospital to the staff, and it was an oncology ward, and I found myself kind of wanting to whisper like cancer. And I thought, well, this is the wrong place to be doing that. it's just this amazing level of denial of what's really, of course, in the Buddhist tradition, the first noble truth, that life has suffering in it.
Yeah. I mean, this is really a great paradox, right? Because oftentimes I'm asked to see people, and the family member will pull me aside and say, don't tell Ma she's got cancer. Don't tell Grandpa he's got cancer. And I'm thinking to myself, there's a 10-foot tall letters outside of this building that say cancer on them. Mm. Everybody's white coat says cancer on it. Do you really think they don't know yet?
Mm.
You know? And so that pressure is still somewhat there to kind of, you know, let's not talk about this. But, you know, it also happens in different gradations. Oftentimes what we find, you know, as healthcare providers, we're human also. And oftentimes there are people that we get very close to who get very bad news. And there's no time to process it individually before you have to share it or something like that. And it's painful to do it. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times what we're trying to do is not really protect the patient, we're really protecting ourselves. And so that's something to be very mindful about, right? Because healthcare is a service profession. We are in service to life and to death and to illness and to wellness. Mm-hmm. And we have to be very aware of our own reactions to it. You know, there's on the one hand, there's nothing special about illness. It finds everybody eventually. On the other hand, there's everything special and unique about it when it does happen, right? So there's a bit of a paradox there. I frequently like to think of the first noble truth as saying suffering is ubiquitous, you know. Asterisk, you don't need to go look for it. It will find you. You
know? Mm-hmm, really?
If it hasn't found you yet, just be patient. It will. Don't worry. Everybody gets called on by that. And so, you know, coming to a place of acceptance that, you know, none of us are exempt, as it says in one of the sutras when he's talking about meditating in charnel grounds, we're to remind ourselves as we're seeing bodies in various stages of decay in meditation and meditating with them, we're to remind ourselves that this body that we have is the same as this body in front of us that we're watching decay. None of us are exempt from this fate. You know, nobody here is going to get out alive, and we don't have to do something wrong, you know, to get ill.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just part of the human condition. It's part of the agreement of birth. These things will happen.
As somebody said once, the best thing you can say about the universe is that it's a bad design. Like, who made it so? You know, like, but it is so. Right. It's right. So.
Yeah. It's really, but then there's the paradox too, right? Because it's also the only vehicle for enlightenment. So.
Uh-huh. And I do say, you know, in terms of the Buddhist cosmology, that the human realm could well be the very best place from which we can get enlightened, because there's just a mixture of pain and pleasure, you know, of suffering and joy. And if our suffering, and of course within the human realm that can be the case as well, but, you know, if our suffering is just overwhelming, then everything is just about surviving. You know, we're getting through the next moment. And if we're having too good a time endlessly, you know, we don't want to bother looking more deeply. Like, let's just play, you know. Cavort, right. and have a good time. And so it's that mix that actually wakes us up.
Absolutely. Like, you know, it helps to have that hierarchy, the base of the pyramid and the hierarchy of needs met, of, you know, the basics of food, shelter, met, so that you can kind of start asking these bigger questions and it's not just a struggle for basic mm-hmm. survival.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about grief for a moment, because I find it a really fascinating topic and hard to also, you know, given a lot of people's cultural conditioning, probably not everybody, but so many people, it's hard to fathom. Like, I remember in kind of in my larger community, somebody died and people started behaving very badly toward one another within the community. And finally somebody said to me, because I was puzzling over that, like, where'd all that come from? And this person said to me, you don't understand. Nobody really knows how to grieve. And I thought, oh, yeah, you know, because of course we also hear those stories of, you know, people who, you know, the family falls apart with acrimony, you know, when somebody's dying. And it really is not about the purses that, you know, who's going to get them or whatever it is. it is that grief that people don't know how to hold that well.
Absolutely. I mean, I see this time and again. There's such a potent, raw energy to grief that I don't know that we really have adequate language to describe it. It's something between grief and trauma for a lot of people. And I do want to kind of say also that grief is very unique. And I really kind of recoil at cookie cutter dictionary definitions of this is what grief is. Grief is whatever it is to you. And that might be completely different from how it is for the person next to you. And we see this in families all the time. Like, people have unique relationships with every family member, right? Like, mom always liked you more, she always liked me less. I mean, that kind of stuff happens all the time. And so people grieve differently. A lot of times people are grieving what was lost. A lot of times people are grieving what was never there to begin with. And this raw energy of grief, sometimes it comes out in different ways. You know, I think when most people think of grief, they think of crying and sadness and depression kind of stuff. But sometimes it can be panic and anxiety. Sometimes it can be rage, anger. Sometimes it can be a stomach ache or low back pain or something like that, or a headache that just won't go away for whatever reason. And so there's different expressions for grief. I think there's a pressure in our society that we move past grief as fast as possible, that there's a right way to grieve and a wrong way to grieve. When in fact, I think there's probably hundreds of millions of different ways to grieve.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's also not allowed. I mean, I often also tell the story with an apology to you, because we are friends, actually. So it has something to do with the punchline of the story. But, you know, somebody came to me once who'd had a terrible loss in her life. And it had been about 6 months before we were speaking, and she said her friends were getting kind of impatient with her, you know, like, hurry up. And believe me, this was not like a 6 month problem, you know. And then she said something very interesting. She said, "My friends all have golden lives. Nothing ever goes wrong for them," because of course that's the pretense. And right. And she said, "Now I'm like a symbol of life gone awry, and I make them very uncomfortable." And I had one of those experiences where I just like heard these words come out of my mouth. And what I heard come out of my mouth was, "I think you need new friends." I said, "You should meet my friends. They're all a wreck." You know, and it's not right. That all my friends are a wreck, but exactly. But, you know, there can be a kind of honesty about our vulnerability, because in fact, we share that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do hear this all the time from people, is that, you know, some variation of the theme that, you know, somebody in my life doesn't think I'm doing it right. They think I'm wallowing it. They think I should be at this stage by now, but I'm only here. You know, something I remind people often is that there's really not many straight lines in grief. It's a natural process, and, you know, nature doesn't work in linear time like our calendar years. It works in cycles, and we have to kind of recognize that grief is natural. It's older than civilization. And so a lot of our understanding of grief is, you know, we're trying to make it fit into our lives. Grief has been around a lot longer than our lives have been around, and it's going to be around a lot longer than our lives will be around. So. It's not very easy to fit it into our busy schedules, right? Like I said with the first noble truth, suffering will find you. You don't need to seek it out. It's the same way with grief. It finds us, and sometimes in the most unpredictable of places, in the most mundane of places, people will find themselves just overcome. And sometimes it can happen, you know, within the first. See, I'm trying to stay away from timelines, because I'm afraid that somebody's going to listen to this and be like, "Oh, so this amount of time is the early part and everything else is later," because it's different every time. So, you know, close to the loss, it might seem like it makes sense to be overcome. And then, but then on the other hand, many, many years later, you might be in a grocery store and a song comes on and it just hits you out of nowhere. Like, oh my God, I thought I was quote unquote better, right? And it has nothing to do with that. This is grief. This is just how it is.
Well, something that's helped me a lot was something I read somewhere where somebody said, grief is love that doesn't have the normal place to land. You know, the person may be gone or the situation, the circumstance, and reminding myself of the love that is really a part of it has been really helpful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, I think, very easy when it's under the wearing the mask of depression or anxiety or anger. It's very easy to forget what kind of tenderness there is with grief. How powerful it is to have a broken heart, to have a heart that is broken open in many instances, and that raw vulnerability that comes with it. Definitely not glorifying it. Definitely do not wish it on anybody. And yet, here it is. And it's important to recognize the different layers of it that can surface in somebody's life. They can be very unpredictable. They can be very unpredictable.
One thing I think we saw in the height or the depths of the pandemic is that grief isn't just about the death of a person necessarily, but can be related to the loss of the future we had hoped for, or a way of life we once had, or even simply aging, you know, as the years went by. And I think it's useful to widen the scope of what kind of losses might deeply affect us.
Absolutely. I mean, I think grief, when we think of grief, normally we think of it as coming from death. Oftentimes, you know, when some of my patients are diagnosed with cancer, it might not be life ending, but it might be life altering. And all of a sudden their life trajectory is completely different. That career that they were on the fast track to, no longer possible. That vacation that they had, you know, planned for the summer, that's probably not happening. And those relationships that you took for granted of, you know, everybody who had a golden life around you, they might clear out. And so there's different kinds of grief that happen with a diagnosis, but there's also grief from any relationship ending, whether it's divorce or graduating from school or getting a new job or starting a new career. You know, a beginning usually has to do with an ending. And so most of our beginnings have just a drop or two of grief in them also. It's important to recognize that. Migration is also profoundly challenging. And there's a lot of grief in migration, in you know, even if it's not going from one country to another, from one city to another, or even part of one city to a different part of the city. I think most people know that, you know, when there's a bad romantic breakup, there can also be grief from that also. Really, I think anything that profoundly shakes up our conception of what we thought our life was going to look like is going to be a potential for grief. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that that's morbid or bad to look at it that way. I just kind of feel like it's realistic. And if we can be realistic about this is what's happening, we can make choices and decisions about how we go about it a little bit more mindfully, a little bit more consciously, with more deliberation and more intention.
So you're part of a lovely new book, anthology, coming out in May of 2024, entitled How to Grieve What We've Lost, Evidence-Based Skills to Process Grief and Reconnect with What Matters. And the book employs tools drawn from acceptance and commitment therapy, mindfulness, and cognitive behavioral therapy. So I'm wondering if you could say a little bit about acceptance and commitment therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. You can say something sure. About mindfulness too, if you like.
Sure. I mean, acceptance and commitment therapy, it started, Steve Hayes found that it was extremely helpful for his patients. I think this was in Reno, Nevada in the 80s and 90s. And really, a lot of acceptance and commitment therapy, most therapists will use the terms ACT to describe it. And a lot of it really overlaps with the mindfulness community and with mindfulness perspectives. It was kind of mindfulness before mindfulness became a buzzword. So, and it's absolutely incredible. Both ACT and mindfulness are both absolutely incredible in these challenging situations that we have no control over, right? Like illness or suffering that seems much bigger than us, like grief. And, you know, it's acceptance is the only option sometimes because there's no budging. But when acceptance is not an option, cognitive behavioral therapy is very effective for many people. You know, where are these underlying assumptions about this reality coming from? What are the underlying thoughts driving our emotions and behaviors? Where did those come from? Are they rational or are they irrational? Do they make sense? Or are we dragging part of our former selves from some other part of our life into a current situation where it's just not effective and not applicable? So all three of these taken together can be very effective in extremely challenging situations where, you know, it can sometimes feel like our tether to reality is tenuous at best and possibly severed. And it's a very, very uncomfortable feeling. You know, Chogyam Trungpa used to have this wonderful saying that the bad news is you've fallen out of an airplane, but the good news is there's no ground. And oftentimes that's what grief can feel like. And I think the parachute in those groundless situations are these three forms of therapy, you know, acceptance and commitment, mindfulness, and cognitive behavioral. Whether they create a ground or not remains to be seen. But I think that might be outside the scope of psychotherapy.
So tell me something about the fact that it's an anthology. I have a list actually with them somewhere. Tell me about the fact that it's an anthology. And did you write a chapter? Is that what happened?
So the book came out because I think that just the collective trauma of COVID has been so overwhelming, and it's really changed everyone's lives so much. Not to mention the hundreds of thousands of people who have died of COVID itself. And I think that's an underestimate because there's a ripple effect throughout our healthcare system that we're seeing, not directly COVID, but indirectly from the pandemic itself and the stressors on the healthcare system that it put. That the publisher felt that, you know, we need kind of an all hands on deck situation here. Let's pull the best of the best in terms of what we found helpful for our readers managing grief, because there's just no shortage of grief now. I mean, when I wrote Grieving Mindfully many years ago, little did I know that we'd be living through, you know, this incredible pandemic. And I do think that society will not be the same in our lifetimes because of this. And we absolutely need to address how we grieve as a society in order to not only honor what we've lost, but to figure out who we want to be and what we want to do with what we've lost. And how we're going to go about doing that can't be the same as it was before the pandemic. That is just not sustainable.
One of the things I've heard you speak about surrounding grief is our ability to dampen the stress response to pain. And this is really taking into account what we now understand through different research about the science of stress and pain, and that when we feel overwhelmed by the pain of our loss, there's actually a lot happening in our brains and bodies. And can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge for any therapist working with somebody going through acute loss or chronic stress or trauma is that our client or our patient might not be able to pay attention to what we're trying to say. And that, you know, oftentimes what happens when we're all of us faced with acute stressors, whatever they may be, we tend to revert back into other ways of functioning that might not be our best possible. And, you know, there's very important and good solid reasons for that. I think the stress response gets kind of an unfair deal. I like to remind people that without the stress response, none of us would be here. If our ancestors weren't really good at being stressed out, they wouldn't have survived. We wouldn't be here. You know, 5, 10, 15, 100,000 years ago, the stress response was about raw survival, you know, against wild animals or warfare or famine. And we had to get really good at getting stressed out when things got dangerous. And so we are really good at getting stressed out when things feel unsafe. And so a lot of times what winds up happening is that the stressors that we're facing now, hopefully they're not direct challenges to our physical safety, but they're very emotional. You know, this sense of loss or re-experiencing trauma or thinking about a loved one who's not next to you anymore or who's not here, it almost automatically triggers this fight or flight survival mechanism, and thoughts start racing. You might get into a cold sweat. Your mouth might get dry. And really the almost universal thing is we start taking these quick, shallow breaths. And what they're doing is they're preparing the body to run away from danger, or if we're going to get cut by an animal or a weapon, to not bleed out. Most of us do this completely automatically. You know, we don't have to think about the stress response. It's hardwired. But I think what winds up happening is that we try to think our way out of the stress response, which really doesn't work too well. You know, if you've ever been stressed out and somebody's told you to calm down, usually that'll just make things worse, right? Like, don't tell me to calm down. I'm stressed out right now. And so what we find is that, you know, what I found is that working with the stress response is a physiological process. And really, this is where the mindfulness practices have come in. This is something that the Buddha taught many, many years ago, is that the mind is going to do whatever the mind's going to do. It's going to jump from branch to branch. It's going to get lost in itself. Come back to the breath. And if we can come back to the breath, it kind of generates a sense of safety in the body. And if the body feels safe, the mind might settle. And if the mind can settle, we may have access to our emotional capacity, whatever that might be, you know, independent of if it's good or bad. Just what is it that we're experiencing? And really, this is something that is so important to think about. Sharon, in your writings, you talk about spaciousness often. Mm-hmm. And I find that that's just such an effective way to think about pain. We don't normally think of spaciousness when we're thinking about pain. But if we can kind of tap into that sense of spaciousness with our breath, it doesn't feel as constricted. It doesn't feel like we're never going to have a normal breath again, or we're never going to be safe again. Working with the breath in the body, dampening that stress response, very important to point out, it doesn't get rid of the pain, and that's not the goal. The goal is to be able to hold the pain in a loving, spacious way. And I find that that is oftentimes challenging for people to accept, but it's also really the only option, right? Because we can't just erase grief. We can't just say, okay, 1 hour with me, and then, you know, you're going to be fine. You'll never feel this again. That's not what's going to happen. It's going to happen. It's going to happen again and again. And, you know, there's no household in the world where nobody has died, right? Every family has been touched by loss. It's been this way, and it will always be this way. And so we have to find a way to not get rid of pain, but to hold it safely with spaciousness and love.
Of course, that's that legendary story from the time of the Buddha about Kisa Gotami, and whose infant child had died, and she couldn't accept that. She kept going to holy people, asking them to revive the child. And she went to the Buddha and he said, sure, there's just one thing, you know, I can do that, but you have to bring me a mustard seed and you have to bring it from a household where no one has ever died. So she went around kind of crazed with grief, going from household to household, asking for a mustard seed. And when they were about to give it to her, you know, she said, but wait a minute, has anyone ever died? And they'd say, of course. And then, you know, she kind of got, I mean, some people find this story really brutal and horrible, but I think what really happened is that she realized she was still a part of life, that this happens for everybody, that she wasn't so alone and kind of especially persecuted by life, abandoned by life, that this was a part of life. And so as these stories always end so happily, she went back to the Buddha, became a nun, became fully enlightened, you know. And,
right.
And that feeling of being so alone is, it just compounds everything. It makes it so much more difficult.
This is something that is still 2,500 years later, very much the case, that when people find themselves, you know, leaving the hospital and the loved one they came in with is not with them, mm-hmm. or they're coming home and there's an empty room or an empty bed or an empty chair, just the gravity of it all. It doesn't seem possible that this is a universal experience, and yet we live in the society we do, that seems to not value relationships and bonds and caring and family time together. And, you know, it just doesn't seem compatible with this universal experience of pain and loss. It's hard to reconcile the two.
Yeah. And I'm very curious about your work with healthcare workers in the depths of the pandemic, because it brings up, it kind of ties in a lot of what we've been talking about. I think, you know, the little bit I've worked with healthcare workers, I'm also continually surprised at how alone they feel and how difficult it is for them to communicate, you know, just what's going on. But you also worked, I think, a lot with the breath and some of the things we've been talking about.
Yeah, the pandemic hit everywhere. Around the world at some point or the other. And when it overwhelmed the hospital system I work for, we were told that, you know, let's minimize staff exposure unless you're working at the bedside with COVID patients, do not come in. And that meant most disciplines were suddenly thrust into either frontline duty that they may or may not have been trained for, or we were doing telehealth from home. And it was very challenging no matter what, because, you know, we were watching our colleagues go in, we're watching our patients getting sick, we're watching all sorts of stuff happening that, you know, none of us were really prepared for, just sort of learning as we go. And so I offered, you know, having these meditation skills, I offered to our intensive care or COVID intensive care nurse managers to coach our nursing staff as they were coming on shift in the morning and in the evening to do a video conferencing, you know, once they're all suited up before they go into these COVID intensive care units where they're going to see people die, guaranteed, maybe many people die in the next 12 hours, to just do some grounding breaths. And so I would walk them through the technique of box breathing, which was very easy to do with protective equipment. And I think more than that, it was this connection to the outside world, that they weren't invisible, that they were being seen, that there were people who knew that they were going into something really horrible, and that we cared for them, and that we cared for their well-being as they were going in to see some very horrible things and bear witness to some very difficult conversations between family members, remotely on an iPad or something like that. And, you know, it's really interesting. All these years later, I didn't know who was participating in these groups. Everybody had protective equipment on, so they were masked up in goggles and face shields and, you know, PPE from head to toe. So I would just see these eyeballs staring back at me through all this protective equipment. And every once in a while, I still get kind of pulled in the hallway or something saying, "Hey, you helped us during the COVID lockdown." I'm like, "Oh yeah, who are you again?" You know? So it really did seem to make an impression, but you know, I don't think it was just the box breathing. I think it was just having the outside world saying, "I see you. I know what you're doing in there. I know this is not going to be easy. And you are being cared for." You know, your nurse manager, myself, my team, we all care about what you're about to experience, and we want you to try to come out of it with the tools that you might need to manage this in some way, because this is so outside of anything we've done before.
Let's talk about working with add-ons, as is sometimes called in the mindfulness tradition, or sometimes it's called the second arrow. And these are the judgments we have about our experiences. So here's a quotation from your new book. "It's common to feel distress about our distress. We feel guilty, sad, angry, or anxious about our sadness. But sadness plus anger, guilt, or anxiety does not equal less sadness. Usually it adds up to more suffering for you and those around you. Guilt, sadness, anger, and anxiety, these feelings about feelings, or what psychologists call secondary emotional processes. Many times throughout our lives, and especially during periods of grief, it is these secondary emotional processes that complicate and magnify our underlying distress. However, in the face of unconditional love and acceptance, even the most intense secondary emotional process can begin to melt away."
Yeah, this is really the most challenging part about the mindfulness practices, right? Because people think that they're going to clear their minds and it's going to be all bliss and easy. But then you start listening and these judgments are coming up. "You're not doing it right. Your posture is not perfect. Why are you worried about the grocery store list?" Or, you know, "Boy, traffic really sucked getting in here." And if you've been doing mindfulness practices or meditating for a while, and these things are almost kind of humorous, like, "Oh, there I go again." But when we're in a lot of pain, that levity might not be there. And so we start kind of passing judgment on ourselves. It's very easy when society is encouraging us to zip through our pain and get it over with so we can get back to work or get back to being productive or, you know, put on a happy front on social media or something like that. You know, "What's wrong with me for feeling pain? What's wrong with me for feeling this way?" It's just so easy to fall into that. And oftentimes what I find is that, you know, when people sit down and start practicing meditation techniques or mindfulness practices with pain, they want all of it to go away. "I just want to feel good." And oftentimes what happens is that the secondary layer gets scraped off and you're left with an emotion that might not be very pleasant. But if that's what it is, that's what it is. And like I said, the point of all this isn't to make it go away. The point of all of this, I believe, is to hold it in a safe and loving way and, you know, kind of weaving a basket to put our pain in, not to cover it up, but just to surround it with acceptance, to surround it with ourselves that, you know, this too is part of my life. This too is now something that's happening to me or with me or between us. And it's also precious. It's also sacred, even if it's so unpleasant.
The five things is a term coined by Dr. Ira Byock, who was a pioneer in the American hospice movement. Can you describe them?
Absolutely. And, you know, these are also from the kahuna tradition, Ho'oponopono in Hawaii. And these are themes that he found at the bedside that really kind of sum up a relationship to bring a sense of completion to it. I hesitate to use the word closure because closure sounds so final. And I find that there's many different closures that happen when a relationship is over. But these five things are themes that really do cover a lot of territory. And I've written them down on paper and handed them to people whose loved ones are in their final days or hours, and encouraged them to have these conversations so that they don't feel like there's a sense of unfinished business between them. And to kind of go over them real quick, some of these are easier than others to say, depending on the relationship. I'm sorry. I forgive you. Thank you. I love you. And goodbye. And, you know, oftentimes people say, well, I have nothing to forgive them for, and, or I have nothing to apologize for. And I encourage people, just say the words, and it can be about anything or about nothing. I think it is very meaningful for people to feel that they were able to have a final conversation. And oftentimes that's not possible, in which case I'll encourage people to do it as a journaling exercise, and kind of writing a letter to somebody who's not in your life anymore for whatever reason, and yet you wish they were, but you couldn't say these words to them while they were with you. You know, I'm sorry, I forgive you, thank you, I love you, and goodbye. I find that oftentimes when the first four are done, the goodbye might be an extra. You know, oftentimes when I'm leaving a patient's room and I'm not sure if I'll see them again, I might just say, take care, or something like that. So, you know, they can be played with, but I think of these as really kind of the essential themes to cover in a relationship. And I find that they're very helpful.
Beautiful. So let's just explore another term, which is anticipatory grief, which is a, you know, phrase we hear. What is it, and how does it hinder our experience? This seems to tie very strongly into mindfulness as well.
Yeah, anticipatory grief is, you know, the concern that we have over a potential or impending loss that hasn't quite happened yet. You know, working very closely with caregivers after now recently myself having been a caregiver, I realized how much caregiving and anticipatory grief are intertwined. And, you know, anticipatory grief is this sense of kind of impending change that might happen, right? Oftentimes it's something that people become very thrust into with a very bad diagnosis, or, you know, if we're talking about a relationship that's coming to an end, you know, the first time you suspect that your partner's cheating, you know, that sense of panic that might set in, or the first time somebody finds a lump or they have a symptom that is very troubling, and there's this feeling of dread. What does this mean? You know, anytime that you find that the future is not predictable anymore, I think anticipatory grief starts to set in some way. And if you've ever asked yourself, I don't know how long I can go on like this, you're probably experiencing anticipatory grief.
And that's what's so, I think, part of what's complicated and confusing, like, because one is still alive, for example, in the process of dying, it reminds me a little bit of, I tell this story in Nepal sometimes about people who are trekking, and they develop this blister on their foot. And this happened to a friend of mine, actually, and the Sherpa guide said to him, you can suffer once, like each time you put your foot down, or you can suffer three times. One is when you anticipate putting your foot down, one is when you put your foot down, and one is when you recollect putting your foot down. So which do you want to do? And so it's sometimes out of kindness to ourselves that we think, yes, I need to grieve this. I need to recognize this loss. And here we are still, you know, in this room.
And, you know, I'm thinking too that, embarking on a spiritual path, I think, is embarking on a journey of anticipatory grief, right? I mean, I think ultimately we're all trying to figure out how to live better.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's a wish that, you know, hope dying goes okay.
Yeah.
Hope I have a good rebirth or something like that. If you believe in such things, right? And that's also anticipatory grief, in a sense, you know, getting ready and being comfortable with discomfort.
Well, since you mentioned being a caregiver, we're recording this in February of 2024. And I know your father died fairly recently. And I just want to say I remember him so well from the time I had dinner at your house. And he was so lovely and sort of trying to come to terms with his new life as well at that point. And I'm sure that it was extremely intense and very important that you were his caregiver.
It was very challenging, but a profound blessing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've just become so acutely aware of how this has always been done around the world, is we die with our loved ones at home.
Mm-hmm.
And the hospital system in which I work, it is objectively a very new development in human existence. And it's sort of taken over birth and death and everything in between, for better and for worse, you know? So having him with us since my mother died, he lived in our house. We all lived together, and his health took a turn in March of last year. And he spent the last 2 months of his life at home with hospice care. And really suddenly had a very steep decline in his last month of life. It really was a profound blessing to be able to care for him.
Mm. And in terms of needing care oneself, you know, when we're frightened, when we feel alone, when we feel overwhelmed, when we're sick, when we're dying, the person I always think of as my greatest model is Ram Dass, who I know has played a big role in your life as well as in mine. And here we are on this podcast, which is held on the Be Here Now network that houses his legacy teachings in podcast form. And, you know, after his stroke, which was incredibly severe, he survived and he lived in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And his speech was strongly impacted, you know, for somebody who'd been brilliantly articulate. He had aphasia and he was still very articulate, but there were big pauses, and his life was different. And once he was teaching on Maui, which is where he'd gone to live, and I was sitting in the back of the room for that session, and he said, you know, the hardest thing of all with the stroke is not even the physical pain, it's not even the difference in my abilities, it's actually having to receive help. And he said, and I knew, you know, I'd known him since January 7th of 1971, which was the beginning of my very first meditation retreat. He was there as a student as well, and I thought this is absolutely true. You know, he was a helper, he was a giver, he took care of others. It was very hard to compliment him or give him a gift or anything. And he said, you know, that was just the hardest thing for me. And it was the hardest thing, but also the most liberating. And he went on to say, you know, one of my most famous books was called How Can I Help? And now I feel like writing a book called How Can You Help Me? And so I felt like, you know, before knowing him as well as I did, it's like the love, the energy, the caring was pretty much going in one direction, which was out. And that when that barrier within him to receiving dissolved, then it could just flow freely in both directions. And I honestly think that's why toward the end of his life, people would say, you know, it's like he was made of light. He was just made of love, you know, because there was no more barrier.
Absolutely. I mean, Ram Dass was absolutely life-changing. I don't even know what to say. Experience, encounter, presence.
Mm-hmm.
Just loomed large, and I had the good fortune to meet him many, many years ago in Santa Cruz. And he was passing through for our lectures, and boy, I just soaked up every second I could with him. And it was just, I think I was like 19 years old or something like that. But to me, it was like just meeting the greatest rock stars on the planet all in one person, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because for my dad, and this is something I would encourage all listeners to do, that what allowed, a big part of what allowed caring for him to be such a blessing and such a rewarding and meaningful task was that I didn't have to second guess. He was driving the show because I was able to have these conversations with him about what his wishes were. Would he want to be resuscitated? What was his red line that he didn't want to cross? What was he willing to live with? What did he not want to live with? You know, he was very clear while he was lucid on what those wishes were. And as his decline started to accelerate, there would be these moments of lucidity where I was able to verify that, yes, I was making the right decisions on his behalf that he wanted me to make. And I think without that kind of what we call advanced care planning, it would have been a very different experience for him and for me. And I think he really very deliberately wanted to make sure that he wasn't going to be a burden and make these wishes known. So I would encourage everybody to have these conversations with your loved ones of what are you willing to do and what are you not willing to do in terms of resuscitation, if you have a life-threatening illness, or if there's no hope of meaningful recovery, would you want to be on a ventilator? Would you want a feeding tube? Would you want chest compressions? What if you were to become bedbound and totally dependent? Is that a life that you would be willing to live? Is that something that you would want to be, to revisit, if it comes to that, to make your wishes known? It's never too early to have these conversations, but oftentimes it is too late to have these conversations. So I think especially if you're living with a major illness or a catastrophic health condition, it's absolutely important to make sure your loved ones know what your wishes are so that they know that what they're doing is based on your wishes and they're not kind of flying blind. It just adds to the stress of caregiving, which is already very daunting.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for being here today. It's such an enormous topic and so important. And I feel like we could just keep going. So we'll have to meet again. And even if virtually, then I miss out on the wonderful Indian meal. But nonetheless, virtually is still nice. And before we finish, I'm hoping you'll lead us in some kind of practice.
Absolutely. Lately in my own practice, I've become much more deliberate in the refuge tree that we sometimes use. And so I thought I would share, in the context of grief, a variation on the refuge tree, using our ancestors and those who have gone from our lives in whatever capacity they've gone, but have touched us while we had them together with us. So to begin, let's settle back into whatever posture you find comfortable, sitting or laying down, and let's take some grounding breaths together. I always like to encourage people to do belly breathing or diaphragmatic breathing. Easiest way to do that is to just make sure when you exhale, the air is being squeezed out from your belly, as if you're deflating a balloon in your belly. Let's just do a few of these. And as you breathe, just notice any points of tension, the tightness in your body and breathe into them, relaxing as you breathe. You may wish to close your eyes, continuing to breathe slow and steady. And in your mind's eye, you can imagine in front of you that which you consider sacred, spiritual, and unique. It can be the Buddha, or Christ, or light. Or it can be your future potential self, the mode of existence that you're striving towards. You can imagine that on your right-hand side, you have all the men in your life that have been helpful. And if you can't think of any, then you can just think of somebody that you wish was in your life on your right-hand side. And on your left-hand side, you can think of your mother, all the women in your life who have been helpful. And if you can't think of any, imagine the women that you wished had been in your life to be helpful. And behind you, you can imagine everyone else, all other beings, whether they're animals or strangers, popular people, anybody who's been influential in your life. And imagine the ones who have left this world, left this life, and touched you in a meaningful way. You're surrounded in every direction by these ancestors, by these relationships that have made you who you are. Imagine that they're all connected to you through your heart. As you're in front of something spiritually meaningful to you, like the Buddha, or Christ, or light, or your future potential self. You feel yourself being held by all of these relationships, safe, steady, protected, and loved, supported on your goal. And spend some time breathing with all of these ancestors, with all of these relationships, all of these beings that have made you who you are today and who you will be in the future. And you can slowly start to move your toes, your fingers, maybe rock your body back and forth, open your eyes. If you come back into normal awareness, carry with you this feeling of being held, safe, protected and loved. We're all connected.
No, that was very, very beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you again for being here, and I hope to see you soon.
Always a pleasure, Sharon. Thank you so much for everything and for being out there. And just, you're just so tireless. You're such an inspiration. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey folks, thanks so much for listening. If you would like to learn more about Sumit and his work, or get yourself a copy of any of his wonderful books, you can head over to his website, SamitKumarPhD.com. That's SameetKumarPhD. And we'll have his website linked in our show notes as well. For all things Sharon, including online courses, her latest books, or to get yourself a free guided meditation, you can visit SharonSalzberg.com. This has been the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.